Ashe.
We'll pour to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know, as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour our shame. We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, John
Henry Clark, John Dr. G. Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
Ashe. History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
California, called Mississippi, or the West. You with your
red, white, and blue dresses, long, straggly beard, pop belly and soggy eyes, pulling rabbits out of your top hat, and rats with welfare checks between their long yellow fangs play in your hair, and your disease is spreading everywhere. But you can't kill me. You can't shoot what you can't see. You thought you shot Malcolm, but all you did was multiply his power. You thought you shot Martin, and black folks got stronger by the hour. You thought you blew away four little girls in Birmingham. The sweet spirit of a lamb cannot die or be denied of life eternally. And we shall live through all the barrages of madness that try to shoot us down in full living color. We will live for Clifford, for Mark, for Fred, Otis, Zade, Arthur, Mrs. King, for George and Jonathan, and all the brothers and sisters who were sacrificed for the price of our freedom and love for living and dancing on clouds, sipping sun rays through a straw. We live in awe of ourselves. You can't kill me. You can't kill me.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep, my sisters and brothers, and welcome to another Tuesday evening edition of the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. The last poets raised the question, how many bullets? How many bullets? How many bullets is it going to take before we said, that's enough, there will be no more? How many bullets? And that's the gist of our conversation tonight. We want to talk about the activism of our community, looking at so many of the horrible and tremendous forms of terror that is being waged against the black community. And so we are asking the question, how many more bullets will it take before we stand up and say no more? And so tonight we have two wonderful guests, two young ladies who are very strong activists. I wanted to get someone to come on and talk with me, somebody who is obviously watching and knowing what's going on, but is not just sitting at home listening to CNN or watching what's on ABC, but are actually out in the streets making the changes that are necessary and fighting and raising their voices, demanding to be heard. So I've asked two wonderful young ladies that I'm going to introduce in just a few minutes to come on. We're so appreciative, as always, for all of you to join us here this evening. This is, again, the Black Reality Think Tank. We are a part of the TimeForAnAwakening.com radio network, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And there are other programs on our system that we're going to talk about later on in our program. We're going to talk about some of the other members of our Black Reality Think Tank family that's also a part of this discussion. And all we are doing is providing a platform for our people to discuss, plan, and implement, just not all talk, implement a course of action for our people. And so that's what we hear, and that's what we are about. We're here every Tuesday, as I said, from 7 to 9 Central, 8 to 10 Eastern. And so we hope that you will continue to be with us and join us and share within our thoughts. We are call-in format. If you would like to call in and participate in this conversation, you can do so by calling area code 215-290-9832. 215-290-9832. And you can participate, ask a question, or if you could just listen, you'll be able to listen as well. One of the features of our program is to always highlight our ancestors. We stand on the shoulders of our ancestors. We walked in the blood that they shed and in their struggles. So we are obligated to do and to talk about them and to call their names into the universe. And our children coming behind us will be able to do the same. Tonight I want to talk about a recent ancestor, a brother that many of you may not be familiar about, but a lot of times we choose our ancestors because these are individuals who have waged war against the established order, who would not have been recognized if they would have given up. And these are people that stayed in the fight and that continued to battle for liberty. A lot of them were musicians, sports figures, but they were working their way through obstacles. They were working their way through things where people did not want them to achieve. There were people that did not want Muhammad Ali to be the champion of the world. There were people did not want Jackie Robinson to knock as many home runs as he did, or Willie Mays to do what he did. They did not want Marian Anderson to sing soprano. And they attempted to block her. And against the odds, they achieved anyway. So tonight I want to talk about a brother. His name is Bob Gibson. Bob Gibson. Bob transitioned on October the 2nd, 2020. He will be remembered most for that which can't be measured or even accurately explained. Sure, there are people who collect a lot of facts and figures, but when you look at this brother, you just cannot match them and say this is normal behavior. His name was Bob Gibson. And when you look at the number of wins, strikeouts, shutouts, Cy Young Awards, Golden Gloves, and then obviously the World Series that he played in, this is hardly unexplained, except he had a tenacity to achieve. But it's the competitiveness, however, that Gibson conveyed and the intimidation he inspired that truly shaped his legacy in this sport. And those are the qualities that we remember most now that he passed away on Friday of last week after a battle with pancreatic cancer. He was 84 years old. The St. Louis Cardinals, the team on which he spent his entire 17-year career, confirmed his death to the press. Gibson passing comes on the anniversary of one of his greatest games, his 17th strikeout performance in Game 1 of the World Series on October the 2nd, 1968. And less than a month after the death of Lou Brock, a fellow Hall of Fame and Cardinal teammate from 1964 to 65. This is a very sad day for all baseball. Major League Baseball Commissioner Ron Manfred said in a statement, he said, Bob Gibson produced one of the most decorated pitching careers in history with his intelligence his athleticism, his durability, and his toughness. One of only three players to be a two-time MVP of the World Series, this legend of October will always be remembered as one of our sport's fiercest competitors. His performance in 1968 with the club he represented all his life, the St. Louis Cardinals, is one of the short list of the best pitching seasons ever. Bob Gibson was a loyal friend to many people throughout the national pastime, and he was deeply missed. On behalf of Major League Baseball, the commissioner said, I extend my deepest condolence to Bob's family, friends, Cardinal fans, and all those who respected one of the greatest pitchers who ever lived. Don Sutton once said that Gibson, said about Gibson, he said he hated everyone, even Santa Claus. He said Gibson's former catcher, Tim McCarver, described him as having eyes smoldering at each batter, almost accusingly. Dusty Baker once said the only two people he ever felt intimidated by were the Bob Gibson and my daddy. And when Baker was preparing to face Gibson during Baker's time when the Braves, Hank Aaron, gave him some advice, he said, don't stare at Bob, don't smile at him, and don't talk to him. If you happen to hit a home run, don't run too slow. Don't run too fast. If you happen to want to celebrate, get in the tunnel first. Indeed, Bob Gibson was often depicted as the meanest man to ever take the mound. And his low, slung cap and crabby countenance, pairing with a vicious slider and a two rations of fiery fastballs to make for a truly imposing presence. He's been painted as a bully with the baseball, unafraid to go up and against any hitter who dared disturb him by inching too close to his precious plate. He was born the youngest of seven children in Omaha, Nebraska, on November 9, 1935, and he was named after his father, who died shortly after his birth. Gibson suffered from rickets. He had asthma. He had a heart murmur as a child, and he needed permission from a doctor to compete in sports. That didn't stop him from becoming a baseball and basketball star at Creighton University, where he was the school's first African-American in either sport. How good was Gibson on the hardwood in 1957, even after signing with the Cardinals to play baseball? He suited up the splashy, flashy Harlem Globetrotters, a marriage that certainly doesn't jive with Gibson's no fun, no frills approach to pitching. But yes, he was quite good, which is why, as the story goes, the Cardinals had to give him an additional $4,000 to persuade him to give up the basketball entirely. Gibson played his earliest professional games in the southern part of the United States at a time when it could not have been easy for a black man. He endured those ugly experiences as well as the difficulty of an initial exposure to the big leagues in 1959 and in 1960. But by 1962, he began to assert himself as a star on the Cubs club, on the Cardinals club that had begun working to ease racial tensions. The initiative in building that spirit, teammate Curt Floyd once said, came from black members of the team, especially Bob Gibson. We, the black players, wanted life to be more pleasant and have championships that were much more meaningful to do. Soon, Gibson and the Cardinals reached the peak of the powers together. Gibson, who became best known as Hoot or Gibby, followed up a 19-win season in 1964 by winning games 5 and 7 in the World Series against the Yankees, the latter in 2 days' rest, to claim the series' most valuable prize honor. All three wins were complete games, as Gibson allowed just 14 hits and 5 walks while striking out 26 people and even homered in Game 7. In 1968, season is remembered as Gibson's very best. He was the face of the year of the pitcher, posting a major league best at 1.12 ERA with 268 strikeouts, 13 shutouts, 15 conservative win decisions, and a stretch of 95 winnings in which he gave up just two runs. He won both the Cy Young and the MVP award that year. And he had a season so uniquely dominant from the pitching perspective that Major League Baseball took the bold step of lowering the mound the following year. Gibson once told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that he pitched that 1968 season with tremendous pressure. He said, "I think I developed ulcers then," he said. "I had a lot of stomach problems, and no one ever knew about it. My stomach was always tied in knots because it was always the sixth or seventh inning, and the score was 1-0, 2-1, and so forth." There would be another Cy Young Award for Bob Gibson in 1970 and a no-hitter against the Pittsburgh Pirates in 71. Gibson continued a stretch of 9 seasons in which he won a Gold Glove. He was respected enough in his retirement years to serve as a pitching coach for the New York Mets, the Braves, and the Cardinals. He was a first ballot Hall of Fame famer in 1881 and an obvious choice of MLB's all-century team in 1999. Bob Gibson, intensity and determination, commanded respect and admiration from his peers on the field, as well as the generation of baseball fans who followed him throughout his career. And that was the story of the great Bob Gibson, who transitioned last Friday evening, October the 2nd. Okay, again, as we've often said, is we like to really profile our ancestors. We just don't want the bio information. It's important that we understand what they went through to achieve the things that they had to achieve. And Bob Gibson very clearly was one of those individuals. Okay, so let us begin our discussion. Tonight we want to talk about activism among the horrifying situations that we have in our community. And I've asked two very powerful young activists to come forward and talk about their experience. And these are activists who are not just behind the scenes, who are not just at home watching CNN or picking up some report or talking to their friends and getting information. These are folk that are out there in the street looking to make change, creating their own institutions to answer some of the ones that are going. If there's an organization or a group that's doing something and they may not be as effective as they would like them to be, these young ladies have started their own, and they are planning to implement them. And I think as older adults, we must support them, talk to them, ask them questions, see if that we can edge them on so that we can answer the last poets in the question, how many more bullets is it going to take for us to do something? So our guest tonight is, first of all, I'm proud to say, is one of our hosts of one of our Black Reality Think Tank families. Her name is Shani B. She is the host of the program After 7. This is a group of young millennials who come on Thursday evening from 6 to 8 p.m., and they talk about different things that face them. And her guest and the young lady that will be coming on, her name is Rebecca Burrell, and she is part of an organization called Revolution Ready. And check that name out, brothers and sisters, Revolution Ready. And they are the founders of this group. It's a foundation. It's called the Foundation for Revolutionary Ready. And her name is Rebecca Burrell and Miss Shani B. Good afternoon, ladies. How are you?
I'm good, Dr. Rogers. How are you?
Wonderful, wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the show tonight.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, thank you. We really appreciate that. We want to kind of talk about a few things, and so we're going to get right into it. At the opening of the program, I don't know if you had a chance to hear it, Ms. Burrell, but there was a song by a very powerful group out of the 60s and 70s by the name of The Last Poets. They did, this was one of the last albums they did. They asked the question, how many more bullets is it going to take for our people to respond? So I want to start off with you all. How many more bullets, Shani and Rebecca, is it going to take?
Becca, did you want to answer that first, or you want me to go in?
You could go ahead.
Okay, well, I do want to correct you on one thing, Dr. Rogers. Okay. Rebecca Burrell is the founder of Revolution Ready, I am, I'm just in to help, you know. Okay. She gave me the title co-founder. This sister has been on the front lines doing all of the work. You know, I don't think it's going to take any more bullets. I think that the young people are fed up. We tired. We sick and tired of seeing our brothers and sisters shot down and beat down in the streets. Mm-hmm. We have resisted. We are organizing, not just on a local level, but on a national level. And we demanding change. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that there's going to take any more bullets. Any more bullets is going to aggravate the situation even more.
Okay. All right. Ms. Burrell?
Yes, I'm in agreement with you, Shani. And it's not how many more bullets is it going to take anymore. It's how much more time is it going to take for us to come into agreement and for us to become more organized and just, you know, submit to one another in our skills, in our strategies, in our organization, in our fire. We don't... We had enough bullets years ago. I mean, it was 400 years ago. It was enough. Right. So really, it's just the season that we are in that has been, it's a divine season. And what we see manifesting before us is already written before us.
Okay.
So it's really not about how many more bullets is it going to take. It's just how many more willing people is it going to take in order to create the change that it is that we need.
I like that. I like that. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about Revolution Ready, the foundation that you all have started. Give us a little background about its purpose and its goals and objectives.
Yeah, so Revolution Ready is something that was given to me during COVID, during the beginning of the lockdown, not knowing that we would be going into social unrest. So then when George Floyd died, that was my cue. Like, this is what you've been sitting in the house. You've been praying. You've been studying. And you've been getting up this courage in order to go out and to come up against the social injustices and the unrest. Mm-hmm. I thought it would be just myself and my family. But as I started to move and get a clearer picture, I realized that it was a brand new family that I was coming into relationship with. So Revolution Ready started as a way to become the glue between different organizations and strategy. I'm a strategist. I like to think things out. I like to count it up. I like to count up the odds before going ahead forward. And also, I would like to see the revolution turn into what it possibly may be, and not to underestimate the enemy. I don't underestimate the people that are next to me, so I'm definitely not going to underestimate the enemy. The enemy is telling us, okay, if we want your blood, then at some point in time, we have to wake up and say, hey, they're gonna have to shed our blood all across this place, this country, because we're not just going to lay down and take it.
Right. I like that.
So it's just plans and strategies in order to be ready for the revolution. It's training, it's education to be ready for the revolution.
Okay, all right. Shani, you want to add to that?
I think she eloquently said it. I mean, everything that she said. And as far as like working with the sisters, being in rooms and making stuff happen, us young people, we're doing it. We're making it happen. Mm-hmm. And we definitely need the support of our people. Okay. So, you know, Revolution Ready is to organize, to galvanize, and to materialize the movement.
Okay.
I don't see this. I think it's ending here. You know, I'm an optimist, and I don't think that we're going to have to do this or fight this fight 20 years from now or 30 years from now.
Right, right. Okay, let me ask this question. let's go to ground zero. You said we're on the front lines in terms of what you all are doing and the efforts you are doing. explain for us real carefully. What is the front lines? What do you mean when you say you're on the front line? What is it? What is that? What is it? Give us a description of that.
Well, I would say the front lines is just being on the front line of a protest, on the front line of organizing, just being out there in the fight.
Okay.
You know, not just watching it from the television, like you said earlier, mm-hmm. but actually being a part of the fight. We've been tear gassed. People that we know have been hit with rubber bullets. Some of Rebecca's friends were a part of the protest. Actually, Rebecca's group before Revolution Ready was a part of the situation that happened in Kenosha where, you know, two men were killed mm-hmm. and somebody's arm was almost shot off. Mm-hmm. So we're putting our bodies in harm's way, you know, just to fight not only for our liberation, but for everybody else's, telling these people that enough is enough and we won't shut up and we won't sit down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. To add to that, the demand. So knowing what it is that our community needs and to boldly put out demands. I know that we have 5 demands out for Wauwatosa right now. Circled around firing Joseph Mensah, the killer cop, the Wauwatosa Police Department, who doesn't use mandatory body cameras. We want to see that implemented. The Wauwatosa Police Department ending the harassment of the Cole family and the people who are protesting. The demand for Wauwatosa to fire the police chief, Barry Weber, and to defund the police 50% of their budget. Goes to the police, mm-hmm. and that is very disproportionate to the needs and concerns of the community. So being able to voice those things that we know that the community needs, mm-hmm. and then to engage in civil disobedience if necessary in order for our voice to be heard and to apply pressure to these politicians who have the ability to make these changes.
Okay. All right, let's even take the camera a little bit closer in on the battlefield. Okay, you got your group on one side, you got the police on the other side. What is the other side saying to you as you confront them? We know what the energy is. The energy is hostile. But what is the actual verbiage between the two groups as you all face each other head on, front line?
I just want to add that it's more than two groups when we go out.
Okay,
when we go out, there's us, there's the police, and then there's the white supremacists.
Okay.
So the conversation that they have is a backdoor conversation that they've already and always had on how they're going to cover each other. So we are being jumped by two different groups. And the conversation that the police have, you already know what that's like.
Right,
they
we know what
that
is.
Come out
right.
And, yeah, and be target practice, and that's what you get. And, you know, different, I mean, whatever it is that you can think of, yes, they said it.
They said it, okay. And, that's
and then it's also the what do you call it, the nonverbals. They don't have to say anything. They do intimidation where they're bringing in a National Guard. They're bringing in the state police. They're bringing in sheriffs. They're bringing in so many different people to intimidate you to the point where people who aren't ready to lay down their lives, aren't ready for the movement, mm-hmm. they leave
okay.
because they're intimidated.
So and then what are you saying when you face them? What is it you are hoping will happen? As you confront them, I just want to make sure that our listeners are clear about the synergy of the battlefield. As you move, what do you want them to do? What would be a victory that you would see that could happen?
It's strategy, Dr. Rogers. It's yes. not necessarily wanting to see them. They're spending money. Their budget is being exhausted by the National Guard, the, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying, the police being around the clock. You know, they're tired. You know, it's a strategy. You know, we're trying to, you know, basically get them to, you know, spend their money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And on top of spending their money, exposing why they don't need 50% of the budget
right.
because they come out and they're militarized. So it's helping their community to see that, okay, black lives may not matter to you, but the moment that you have an issue with this government, you can be rest assured that this is how they will deal with you as well.
Mm-hmm.
They will come out with rubber bullets. They will come out with their military gas. they will come out with their fight strips and tear up your car. They don't even read Miranda rights. And honestly, they have been detaining people in Mayfair. How can you detain people in a mall?
Mm-hmm.
How can you detain people and not give out any information? It's showing how they break the law. They're lawless.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's bringing attention to, and that causes more people to enter into the fight. As there's a cycle. Some people are leaving the fight because of their fear. And then some people are entering into the fight because they're like, what do we have to lose? Because the moment that I don't agree, this is what's going to happen to me and my family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly right. You have to draw out evil. You have to expose it. You have to pull the cover back so that people will know what that is. Because as long as it stays undercover, it can work effectively and be, in a lot of cases, a lot more intense. So by exposing it like that and showing the ugliness of that does really do something. It's very interesting, too. And I don't know if you all are paying attention to this. Your efforts are being supported in a lot of different other ways. For instance, give you an example. There are a lot of people now, there are a lot of institutions, for instance, that are telling the stories that support your aggression and support what you're doing. A case in point, right now there's a series that's running, it's a movie that's on Netflix that's about the 1970 Democratic Convention situation, riot, and what those marchers were doing and what those protesters were doing was trying to bring out the ugliness of the Chicago police and obviously showing that it was the police that were the rioters and not them. And so as people attempt to try to form public opinion with all of these other incidents and these other narratives being told, it kind of shows that this is the general consensus. Because I remember during the 60s when we were marching to try to integrate the Woolworths and the places like that. And I recall the same kinds of situation. We were being confronted by the police. We were being called names on the sideline. They were throwing urine at us, glasses of urine and feces, as we walked. And we were young as ourselves. We were college students in our teens still. But it didn't care. We didn't care. We weren't afraid. So when you look back over the years at how these things are, it's just a continuation of that, which is the message for you. Is this is why you can't give up either, because there's a generation falling behind you that's watching you too, and they're going to have to confront this in some way. It just seems to be that this fight is going to be on and on, because we're dealing with people that don't seem to have compassion, that they want to stop, and then they're not going to stop. I hope you're right. I hope there are no more bullets, but I don't think that's going to be. But that's just my opinion. Into that. We're going to open up and let our audience also give their input on that as well. But that's a good point that both of you make, is to try to expose the ugliness of that and expose, you know, who those folk are that are out there. Now, the white supremacists that are out there, are they identifying themselves as that, or is it just you just listening to their language? Is there a way that you can know, for instance, who they are?
Not really. You know, they kind of hide on the cuts and, you know what I'm saying? They know where we are. They'll drive around in cars. I haven't seen any that identifies, but Becca may have a different story. I mean, I think that, you know, they try to infiltrate, you know what I'm saying, a group sometimes. Sometimes, you know, you might see a person try to, you know, aggravate the crowd, but I don't know. Becca, have you had any experiences with people identifying themselves?
Oh, yeah. So when we went to, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay. When we went to Kenosha, there were about 40 of them posted up, guns, waiting behind a U-Haul building for our response. When we went to get people out of jail in West Dallas, they were sitting on a corner. It was about 40 of them. We knew exactly who they were. But the difference between them being here in West Dallas and being in Kenosha is that they were similar to the feds. So we didn't know if they were federal agents. We didn't know if they were white supremacists or who they were exactly. Mm-hmm. But we just knew that they were against us. They wasn't for us.
Okay.
So, yeah, they make themselves known. They put big flags on their cars.
Okay. And
they call themselves Proud Boys. Yeah, we know.
One of the reasons I wanted to ask is that I know that you all have a lot of white students marching with you all?
Yes, we do. We have more white people marching with us than black people.
Do you know who they are and where they're from? Do you have the privilege? Do you know that?
After 100 and almost 50 days, yeah, we've gotten to know each other quite a bit. We've become like a family.
Okay, so now who are they? What is their MO?
They are people who just are, they are people who are just against the government, people who genuinely care about black people, black lives. They become like brothers and sisters to us.
Okay.
Some of them are business owners. Some of them are, you know, outlaws. Some of them are what we would call outlaws, you know, kind of like black sheep. So, I mean, some of them are students. We have older people who we call them protest dads sometimes because he's an older guy. He's retired. He's out there. He's supporting whatever resources he can bring. He'll bring rain, sleet, or snow. He's actually out here tonight, you know, and just genuinely cares and shows his care for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you had any confrontation with the government official? Have they called you to have a meeting or to sit out and talk? Have you confronted them or they confronted you in that way?
I mean, yeah, we had a little riffraff before. We had letters put out, but they were corrected. Statements were recanted. We actually sat down with Mayor McBride today and had a conversation with him along with a representative that works with Jesse Jackson. And we sat in the room today and had a conversation with that family and with the lawyers. So, I mean, yeah, we're calling them to the table.
Okay.
That's most definitely.
And without revealing anything that's not sensitive, what is the conversation like? What is the gist of the conversation in that dialogue?
I believe the conversation is, oh, man, we forgot you niggas could read.
Okay.
That's what it is, because we come in there and we're educated. Mm-hmm. We're following you. We are holding you accountable to the statements that you've made. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they try to play the stupid card, like, oh, I'm not sure. Oh, I don't know. Or, you know, but, mm-hmm. you know, we call them to the table.
Okay. Were you in any of the meetings when Reverend Jackson was there?
He wasn't here. His representative was here.
Okay. And that's the Rainbow Coalition? Is that who that is?
That's it.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Let's do what they are. Now, that it's interesting because now in when you all galvanize, you obviously meet and talk and strategize, correct? You do that.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's good. That's it. So you go at it as an organized group because there's some thought that it's just rabble-rousers, just people getting out there hollering and screaming and looking for root, but we know better. You know, we know that it's a strategy session, just like it was during the civil rights years. There were strategy mm-hmm. sessions that were held a lot of times before we went. We used to go and pick up the picket signs from a church,
mm-hmm.
One of the churches in the community, and we would go pick up our picket signs from there, and then they would give us the instructions on what to do and what to say and what not to do and what not to say as we move forward, you know, in the legal part. And very clearly that was very helpful for us as well, too, as you were moving forward. So, okay, that gives us a real good bird's eye view of the battlefield. And I thank you for that. I appreciate that and how you do that and looking at that. So now, if you had to assess this confrontation, where would you say the meter is moving? Is it moving toward improvement? Is it at the middle? Or is it still down into ain't no changes?
I would say it's moving towards improvement.
You can see that.
The chief of police for Milwaukee was demoted, which seemed like not a win. Okay. But eventually it became a win because he decided that he was going to quit. So he quit because of his ego that wouldn't allow him to be demoted. But had we not been out marching and put the demand on the chief and been in front of his house and putting pressure on him, he wouldn't have been demoted and he wouldn't have quit.
Okay.
Another solution that we have come up with is the community oversight for the police, which just got passed by our brother Nate Hamilton. And being in those rooms with the with black officers and people who want to see change and actually coming up with a coalition in order for that to come to pass. So that's a major thing because that's something that can silently end qualified immunity for officers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. So you can see that moving in a way that kind of gives you more motivation to stay in the battle. Do you all have a legal team? You have a legal folk to support you?
Yes, the Justice Project, and she is Kimberly Motley, looking for more lawyers, more good lawyers that will be able to join the project in order to help out with the different delegations that she has. Yeah.
Right. Okay. That's good. You know, it's so interesting, and I don't know how much historical legwork you do. Wisconsin is a unique history to this whole resistance idea of things, particular Kenosha. Kenosha is real funny. That's a funny area. Number one, it's a very large Italian community. I overheard the director of the Wisconsin office of the FBI once say that it was the suburb for the Chicago mob, and without going into any more details of that, but I thought that was an interesting statement. And it also was a very heavy automobile industry subsidiary town. There were some cars that was actually manufacturers that were there. There was an older automobile called the Hudson. The Hudson was manufactured right there in Kenosha. And it's a large German presence as well, too. And the reason I'm saying that is when you go back and you look in the history of unions and big industry, they've always been, that has always been a very toxic, tense kind of environment. And they've secluded, tried to keep other people out. And the African American community has been very small, you know, in those towns like Kenosha, Racine. Milwaukee is always the biggest one. That's why Milwaukee has more black population than anything. The whole Wisconsin area is the home of the John Birch Society. A lot of it, a lot of people in there are John Birchers. John Birchers are still around. The John Birch Society is the suit-wearing, wingtip version of the Klan, and they're very biased. But they do the strategizing, where in terms of business, of setting up things. There's no coincidence. The Koch brothers' home base is Wisconsin area, like that. So you know you're interested. You're in a heavy fight. A lot of resources. I was looking at an article today, and then I'm going to open up for our audience. I was listening to an article today, how much money from Wisconsin is being given to the Trump administration. Millions and millions of dollars, because there are these big industrialists who are here in Wisconsin that you don't know about. A lot of them are quiet. And they are donating and funding through dollars the support of those forces that you were trying to fight. And so your work is intense, and I'm not saying that out of fear or anything like that. Is that I'm saying that you're doing it the right way, because you're going to need all of that, and you're going to need all of the support you could get. Let me ask you this, and then I'm going to open up the lines. How could the community, folk that are listening now, how could they help you? What would be a way because a lot of folk are older. They're not going to be able to come out on the battlefield and march with you every day. But how can they help you in this struggle? What would you like to see them do and be able to do for you as you begin to continue this battle?
Well, I'll start off. Most importantly, support the movement, you know, by donating goods or services, money. There's always something that these young people do. There's some young people who have given up their lives to make sure that this movement is a success. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people, are the Justice Project, the lawyers aren't free. You know, there's so many different things that people can do, and they don't necessarily have to be on the front line.
Okay, okay. Ms. Burrell?
Yep, I have to agree with that. And also, whatever your gift is, whatever your skill is.
Ms. Burrell, we can't. Ms. Burrell, if you're talking, we can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Okay, I can hear you now. Uh-huh.
Whatever your skill is, whatever your talent is, whatever your gift is, apply it to the movement. Getting the word out. Word of mouth is good, but promoting things that are going on, helping people to be on the same page, helping to become more organized, showing up to meetings, educating. If you're younger, educating the older. I mean, if you're older, I'm sorry, educating the younger. And just staying in the loop of what's going on, writing letters, sending letters to the mayors, to the chiefs, making sure you vote and do the different things that it takes in order to bring about the necessary change.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. And how would they do that? Is there a number or address, a P.O. box, or something that folk could call and if they need to? And we're gonna give this a couple of times out to our audience in case there is somebody out there that would like to help in some kind of way. Is there a number or either a method?
There's so many different, organizations. The organization that we represent is Revolution Ready. We have a Facebook page, Revolution Ready.
Okay.
Becca, do you know the Instagram page?
Yep, it is r_love_ocean. And then every other page is at Revolution Ready One. And then if you want to email us, that's probably the best way. If you would like to donate or if you would like to do research with and for us, if you would like to just incorporate yourself in what we have going on, you can email us at revolutionready.wi@gmail.com.
Okay, say that once more. Say it a little slower. Say it a little slower. Say it once more.
revolutionready.wi@gmail.com.
Okay.
And Doc, I also want, before you get to the guests and stuff like that, I want to, you know, just make mention of the young lady that we have on the call. She was responsible for bringing Rock Nation to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She organized a rally last week Thursday with the Gathering for Justice, which is Harry Belafonte's organization. And I mean, this sister is doing great works. As you can see, she's on the phone and she's working and protesting at the same time. So I'm glad to be a part of an organization like that. And, you know, if you guys are going to donate, you can donate there or you can donate to any organization, but just help the movement, push it forward, because we need the support, not only from, you know what I'm saying, each other, but we need it from our elders. There's a lot of young people who do want guidance, who do want, you know, to sit down with an elder and strategize. So we definitely need those voices in a room, and we need those voices to be heard.
Okay, good. Well, explain, just for any of our audience that may not know, what is Rock Nation? What is that?
Rock Nation is an organization that is owned by Jay-Z. I'm not good with this music stuff, but they have been an influential support system towards the movement. They have given a few dollars to help out with the protesters and, you know, covering the bails for the protesters and also for some of the legal situations. Oh, yeah, right. So Rock Nation has definitely been owned by by Jay-Z has definitely been influential in the movement.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that he has definitely been behind bailing out individuals and things like that, that the rest. Because, you know, and that's good. I hope those who are listening, this is a I know who's listening on via the switchboard, but those of you who are on the internet, you can call in and ask questions, or if you need to get some clarity about something, area code 215-490-9832. Area code 215-490-9832. You can call us and get any information that you want, provide maybe even suggestions that might be made to these two young ladies. One last question, then I'm going to definitely open it up this time. And I would like for you, both you and Ms. Burrell, to answer this. There's a lot of dialogue sometime in our community about this voting thing and whether or not voting is really necessary. I know one of our Black Reality Think Tank programs had a discussion on a couple of days ago called To Vote or Not to Vote. Is that a question for us? How do you all see that?
So, Doc, I think I talked about this before. I am a pro-voter only because I know what not voting does, and because I've come from a lineage of people who, you know, fought for the right to vote. In 1965, Black women were given a right to. And, you know, on the ballot, we're seeing things that impact our communities, directly impact our communities with issues that directly impact women, and not taking part and participating in something like that. I feel like I would be a part of the problem and not the solution. I can't complain about the problems in my community if I'm not doing anything to change them. So that's my viewpoint on voting.
Okay. Ms. Burrell, any thoughts you have?
I would say we do ourselves a disservice if we do not vote. I think that more of our people need more education as far as voting outside of the presidential campaign, because that is not to say all be all. As we know with Barack Obama, when he was president, he didn't have the House. So anything he tried to do, he faced resistance. So if we can put that same resistance up with the presidential campaign, with the candidate that we have now, then we could be changing a lot of things. I mean, we have to understand that it's not just about Biden and Trump. And we definitely, like the mayor that we're trying to get rid of now, I mean, sometimes people have to resign in order for them to get out, or you have to collect all these petitions in order to even put it on the table. I think that we need more education about legislators.
Okay.
And the impact that they have on our community. So please vote.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and open up our lines to our guests. We are here with Ms. Shani B. And Ms. Rebecca Burrell, part of an organization called Foundation Revolutionary Ready. Revolutionary Ready. And so we'll be right back in just a second.
What you're calling African history and Negro history are the missing pages of world history. Go study the history of your masters. Go study the history of the people who enslaved you and find out why they found it a necessity to remove an entire people from the respectful commentary.
Attack our country.
Americans are terrorists, killing the natives of the land.
Terrorists.
Killing and stealing has always been a part of America's master plan.
Terrorists.
To control the earth and everything on it, to divide and conquer is all they want.
Terrorists.
America's a terrorist. Buffalo that roam the plains,
slaughtering animals was turned into a game. Giving blankets contaminated with smallpox to the natives who were here. The beginning of germ warfare. The beginning of white fear. No respect for the land, the trees, or the air we breathe. And Christianity was an excuse to bring others to their knees. America's a terrorist with a slave system in place. To take away the humanity of a darker race. Put people in chains, then beat them with whips. Made them give up their names. Those who survived the slave ships. America's a terrorist. Chewing tobacco and eating swine. Being mean and nasty to those who treated him kind. Take a pregnant black woman, cut her belly open. And let the fetus fall out. Stomp the baby in the ground. To instill fear is what that was all about. Gang up on a black man. Hang him from a tree. Cut him down and set him on fire. For everyone to see. America's a terrorist. With a howdy doody grin. Using the Bible to keep others in check while America commits all the sin. Thou shalt not kill. That's not part of the American dream. Because to kill is a thrill they love to show on the TV screen. Romance a gun just for fun. Drop a bomb just for charm. This is the American way. And all this talk about equality, justice, and peace. Terrorists. Spewing out of the mouths of these governmental beasts. But every time blacks tried to find a way to do for self, the American terrorist wasn't having it. And fear is all black folks felt. Rosewood was a town where blacks tried.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, I guess we're having some technical difficulties, but we're going to get back into our topic. Becca, you still with me, girl?
I'm here.
Brother White, do you hear me?
I'm here.
Brother Herbie White, do you hear me? Okay, Shannon, do you hear me now?
Yes,
yep,
I hear you, Dr. Rogers.
Okay, good. Okay, all right. We weren't sure. All right, I see what something had happened. Okay, again, then we are back. As I said, we are back with our two guests, Ms. Rebecca Burrell and Ms. Shannon B. They are part of an organization called Revolution Ready. And it's a foundation, and they are sharing with us some of the functions of the battlefield that they are involved in right here in Wisconsin. They've shared for us some information and given us their ideas. Just want to remind our audience that we are part of the TimePointAwakening.com network, which is a part of the Block Talk Radio network. We are here at this program every Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 Central Time. And there is a list of other programs that play on the Time Point Awakening network system. On Mondays from 11 to 1 Eastern Time, we have African Perspectives with Brother Oshiemi Adelabu, 11 to 1 every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. From 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with host Jihad Ahmed, 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds every Monday evening right here on Time for an Awakening. And then from 8 to 9 Eastern, Black Therapy Central with Dr. Cambone and Sister Nataki Cambone, Black Therapy Central. And then from 9 to 10 on the first and third Mondays, we have conversations with reparations from the NCOBRA organization every Monday from 9 to 10, first and third Mondays of the month. And then Tuesday, as we said, Black Reality Think Tank. And then on Thursday, 7 to 9 Eastern, after 7, with host Shani B, Lady B, Maya Marie. Excuse me. And then on Friday from 8 to 10, we have Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, 8 to 10 Eastern Time on Friday, Time for an Awakening. And then on Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern, Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. And from 7 to 9, the Elders of Sankofa. That's every Saturday from 7 to 9 Eastern. And then on Sunday, Time for an Awakening again from 7 to 9 Eastern with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. This is our lineup. You can go to the archive at www.timeforanawakening.com and get any of the programs that have aired in the past and have an opportunity to listen to them as well. And so we thank all of you, our audience that are on now with us and who have here we can participate in this conversation by calling area code 215-490-9832. We would love to hear from you and love to hear your comments. Okay, let me go to Brother Herbie White and ask Brother White, what advice or what thoughts would you give these young people who are out there on the battlefield every day? What are your thoughts on what they're doing?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and sir. Two beautiful young black women that's on the show. Resistance to white supremacy and abuse has been an ongoing struggle in this country since the very beginning. And with what I'm seeing right now in the protests and the struggle that the young people are conducting, I'm personally convinced that people like Harriet Tubman and Ida B. Wells, Marcus Garvey and Nat Turner would be extremely proud of what they're doing.
Okay, great. I agree.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Brother White, as always. Appreciate your comments. Brother Lush, what do you think? What do you got to say to these young folks? Brother Lush, Montgomery, 334.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was on mute. Sorry.
That's right.
Well, good evening, Doc Rogers, and good evening to your guests. The question I have, and based on some observations on and what I've already heard. It's interesting, back in the 60s, they were mostly men as part of this struggle, and you don't hear very much about the women. Of course, Elaine Brown did her book about A Taste of Power, a black woman's story. I'm curious to know, what role are black men playing in your Revolutionary Ready program today? How are they utilized with regards to lending services, time, energy, and effort, strategy, protection for you guys? So where do black men play a part in this program?
Great. Good question. Good question.
I can answer that question. Just for perspective sake and background sake, my family were the NAACP Youth Council, in which my father was the youngest member, and my cousin Marianne was the oldest member and the leader of that organization. So just putting that in perspective, we do have men on our core team. We also have mentors who are men, and we have a coalition. So we never, Revolution Ready does not ever stand alone. Revolution Ready is about gluing, being the glue between each organization and making sure that people whose voice needs to be heard is heard, and people who need to be utilized in a certain capacity is using that capacity, because it's for the betterment of all of us. So men definitely play a role. This is not a feminism movement. And I keep in perspective my family who came before me as I carry the torch to just be what they have been an example to me. You know, I have become what they have shown me already.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, Sister Sharon and Sister Burrell. Thank you.
Okay. Brother Timothy, how are you doing today, my good brother?
Oh, I'm doing fine, sir, and I'm happy that you picked these black queens to be on the program. And I'm going to say to these ladies that we have the same in Philadelphia, and I think we and you folk and our folk need to recognize who's on our side. To give you an example, in Philadelphia, we have a commissioner, a sister. First time we had a sister that's a commissioner. And we are up to 370 murders. Mm. And I'm saying to myself, inviting out here in a revolution for economic, political, and social order, that we're killing one another. So us fighting against the enemy, but we're fighting against ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have to figure that out, why we kill each other. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that, and how we betray one another. You know, betrayal is one reason why we're over here in bondage. Mm-hmm. Is that anytime you have someone who has a little money and makes it to Hollywood from rapping, and he goes to a president, or somehow he's connected, and he's going to give the African-American, so this president says, the African-American community $500 billion to help us. See, we no longer need to be hoodwinked. And these African-American men and women who make a little money, who want to talk to the enemy, we want to know what side are you on when we're fighting. In other words, sister, I see you over in Wisconsin. I'm with you. I'm in Philadelphia. Let's get together. But we can't have no turncoats and traitors that's going to sell us out. Mm-hmm. So we got to line up with people who are with us, and not somebody who's like 50 cents now who is worried about his tax base. That little bit of money he got, these little rappers got, they ain't nothing can compare to what these people have who run this country. Whose side are you on? I mean, I'll tell you another thing. I hope these black men and women don't think they're accepted.
Right.
The white man will never see you as his equal. I'm going to give you this, some of this advice, because I'm in the same struggle that you in. I'm on the hook up. Guess what? We got to get rid of our traitors if we're going to fight this enemy.
Mm-hmm. So can I respond to that, Doc Rogers?
Please do.
Okay, so we definitely know who's on our side and who's not on our side. One of the guest speakers that we had speaking at the rally was famous for her famous saying, all of our kin folks ain't our skin folks. Or did I say that right, Becca? All of our skin folks ain't our kin folks. I said it backwards. All of our skin folks ain't our kin folks. And for those of you who are familiar, her name is Tamika Mallory. She's been the driving force behind the Breonna Taylor family, getting that message out there, talking about it, and supporting the family. So with Revolution Ready, we definitely know that people who look like us may not necessarily be for us. Mm-hmm. And as Becca said it earlier, the majority of the people that are walking with us our white, you know, our white allies. I want to say when we were on the front line a couple of weeks ago, there was a disabled white boy, white man, excuse me, standing on the front line next to me and my sister. So, I mean, we're not afraid, you know what I'm saying, to be on the front line or anything like that. We're not seeking or looking for protection because we're willing to, you know, lay our lives down on the line for what we believe in. But we do know that there are infiltrators and they don't have to necessarily be white. They can be black. Right, so right. We definitely deal with that on a daily. We were just, and Becca has a podcast that I'm a part of. It's called Revolution Ready also. And when we find and identify those people, we don't just keep it to ourselves. We give them a reward called the Bootlicker of the Week. Okay. Becca, did you have anything to add to that?
Oh, yeah, we definitely make it a culture to call out the bootlicker. And I also want to add that hatred has no color. So, yeah, we do have skin folk that ain't our kin folk. You know, we have white supremacists, but then we have those who stand with us. So it's being able to discern and look at the heart and know, you know, who God sent or not.
Right.
It just comes down to that, who, right and wrong. Who's going to do right and who's going to do wrong?
Right.
Because I got family that still sits at home while I'm on the front line. Or while I'm organizing, you know what I mean? While I'm coming up with solutions and down talking me and downplaying what's happening and telling me how crazy I am when they're still asleep. So I definitely understand what you're saying, brother, and we should hook up because in order for us to win this fight in America, it can't be little pockets of fights. It can't be little pockets of revolution. We have to come together as a nation within a nation and make things happen and make them see what it is that we see.
Excellent. Well, I'm gonna say this to you, sisters. The nationhood is the key, but you know there were a few people in the Black Panther Party that were white, and those same men that helped Huey P. Newton during this trial are now conservative.
Right.
So we have to look at that. But women, at the same time, you know, you see a Jim Brown who you want was red, black, and green. It was in the struggle, and now he's sitting down with Trump. So we gotta recognize who's our enemies. Before we fight, anytime you go out there and battle, you got to know your enemies first. Did you know what the other person looks like?
Right.
So I'm with you. But let's fight the fight with the enemies that look like us to get to the other enemy that don't.
Right. Thank you. Let me ask you, ladies, what about the black churches of Kenosha, Milwaukee, Racine? Have they come forward to provide support? Shani or Ms. Burrell, have they come forward?
I'm going to answer this one because I just did a podcast on this yesterday. I believe it was yesterday or the day before yesterday.
Okay.
No. So a lot of people are looking for the church to enter into the revolution, and what they get is something that they don't expect because in order for you to live in this capacity, you have to live outside of the four walls. And so when we step out, I am a part of the church. I believe in Yeshua HaMashiach, who America knows as Jesus Christ. And when we step out into the streets, we don't look like what it is that they think that we should look like. So they feel like the church has not stepped out. But the church has definitely stepped out because I have and the people around me have. But if you mean the institution, no. We've asked churches for money to help lawyers, help with lawyer fees for the Cole family, Jay Anderson, and Antonio Gonzalez. And that is something that they don't want to involve themselves in as of yet. But it's always time and chance to fall around, turn around. So
okay.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Right. So they have that. And that's interesting because in the 60s, there were churches that were involved in the movement of things. And they did come forward with funds and housing and all kind of different areas of support in a lot of cases. Some cases it didn't. I mean, a lot of them were not active. And they felt that even King and the SCLC was doing the wrong thing by marching and boycotting and doing all of that stuff. What about the NAACP? Have they reached out to help you all?
No.
And can I say something, Doc?
Yeah.
I just really want people to understand why people in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Kenosha, I'm pretty sure y'all heard of Jacob Blake. Him being shot 7 times in the back as he was walking away from a cop. You've heard about the Kyle Rittenhouse, who's still current day in the custody of a juvenile facility after killing 2 men and openly carrying a gun, and then also almost shooting the arm off of another person. So he killed two people, almost killed the, or took the arm off of somebody's arm, took the arm off of somebody, and he was able to go home and go to sleep. Because we were protesting a man who was walking away from a cop, not with a gun, but with a knife, walking away from a cop. We're also protesting because of Tracy Cole. Tracy Cole, her son was murdered by the Wauwatosa Police Department by a man by the name of Joseph Mensa, who killed three people, a total of three people. And to add insult on top of injury, a couple of weeks ago, they pulled this woman out the car. They manhandled her. They twisted her arm to the point where she thought it was broken, gave her two black eyes and a knot on her head the size of my fist. And they told her they don't give a fuck who she is, excuse my language, after she repeatedly told them, I am Tracy Cole. They are protesting for my son. I am Mama Cole. I'm Mama Cole. And they told her they don't give a fuck who she is. Excuse my language, but this is what they said. I mean, for the churches, the NAACP, and anybody else who's not in support of the movement, and they are just sitting down and letting, you know, this happen, I don't know what to say. You know, we got to stand for something or fall for anything, because I don't know Mama Cole before this situation. I didn't know any of these people, but I have compassion, and I have a son who's 18 years old, and that could be my son.
Right.
And I will hope that it doesn't have to be anybody else's.
Exactly. Brother Marcus, any thoughts you have?
Yes, Dr. Rogers. Good evening. Good evening to your guests.
Yes.
You know, we have to bear in mind, you know, both political parties play black people. So it's not all the good Democrats or the bad Republicans. Both of them play us. You see?
Yeah.
So what the, you know, what the brother is trying to do, what I think Ice Cube is trying to do, is trying to get some capital into the black community. You see, sometimes you have to sit down with the devil. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because what we are advocating for is wherever black people make up the mass majority of the population, black people should control the economics and body politics of that community, mm-hmm. regardless of who the hell is in power. That's what we want, okay? We tell that to the Democrat, we tell it to the Republican, we tell it to whosoever the hell is there. We want economic and political control of the communities that we reside in, because that is not the case now. The case now is other people in our community mm-hmm. are carting out the money daily out of the community. See, that's what we need. We need economic parity.
Yes, yes.
So I don't care who the hell is there. There's no good, some good white man. You know, there was a parable, you know, the African, all right. He said that the white man was in Africa, and he saw the alligator, it's in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So the young warrior was swimming in the water. So the white man took his gun and boom, and he shoot the alligator. So the young warrior came out and he shook the white man's hand, said, thank you, went to the hut, got the machete and came back and chopped off the white man's neck. So the elder African was sitting there, said, why did you do that? You know? He said, look, I've been swimming with these alligators here for eons, okay? And they didn't do me anything. And he said, you know, one day we're going to fight. So, he said, look, I don't want to have a problem to when the war come, I got to decide which is a good white man from which is the bad white man. So he deal with them the same way we got to deal with them. You see, you know, we have no friends outside of the race, and unfortunately, we have very few friends within.
Right.
See what I'm saying?
Right.
So we got to look out for our interests. It's our race come first. So we don't care who the hell is there. This is what we want. Anyway, that's all I got to say. Good brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Marcus. Thank you so much. Area code 646-626. Would you like to add to this conversation, caller?
Hey, Dr. Rogers, how you doing? It's Jay.
Hey, fine, my brother. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to catch up with you, Elder, but I've been a little busy.
That's all
but
right.
I always try to do catch you when I have a moment to catch you, because you always do such great work.
Thank you.
But I came in maybe a little late, but I was wondering if one of your guests had a problem with what Ice Cube and 50 Cent was doing in regards to the situation with Trump.
Okay. Shani? Or either Ms. Burrell, you have remarks about what they were doing in terms of Donald Trump?
I have no comment on that. I don't really, don't care what somebody's personal viewpoints and, you know what I'm saying, who they support as a candidate. But I do care about somebody who does not exercise their right to vote. So if that's the way they feel, they're doing it for economic reasons, even though, you know, it may be a problem with the people. You know what I'm saying? Like if Trump was to present a plan that was going to benefit Black people, you know, then there's something to listen to. That's what Ice Cube is saying that he's doing. But if you're doing it for financial reasons, such as 50 cents, I mean, it is what it is. You know, he showed you guys or the people where his priorities lie. So I feel like we should just boycott him and don't support anything that he's doing, you know, but that's my personal viewpoints, mm-hmm. You know, but, you know, everybody may look at it differently. But at least he's voting. I can definitely say that.
Ms. Burrell?
I'm hearing a lot of talk about what they're doing because it's controversial. But I'm not hearing a lot of talk about what Puff Daddy just said the other day about having a Black party, in which he's saying, had he known before, had he, you know, had the light come on before, we could have been organized and prepared to have a Black party so that when we get to the place where the funk is hitting the fan, and, I mean, we always have to choose between the lesser of the evils, and we get ourselves in this bind, that we will have an option. Like, we haven't even had an option, because a lot of people have not been paying close enough attention or cared enough or have been too comfortable in where they are now. So anybody who's speaking up and causing controversy, I thank God that Trump became the president, because even had not become the president, would we have feathers been ruffled? You know, would we have gotten to this place of revolution? No, because it wouldn't have been such controversy. He woke up sleeping giants, and that's on both sides of the fence, both racism and the Black community and those who love and hate. It's just really love against hate at this point in time. But I wouldn't dwell too much on what Ice Cube and 50 Cent got going on. Yeah, they trying to get money in the Black community. That's fine. Let's go. Get the money in the Black community. But what does it matter if you get money in the Black community, but you still promote music that causes, that leads our young people astray, like leads them into violence. Like, you're still going to be the blind leading the blind. But I would like to have more of a conversation around the positivity that is coming from P. Diddy right now about having a Black party, because that's a conversation that we should have had years ago, generations ago.
Okay.
One would have to first understand that those individuals really have no plan, just like one must also understand that Biden nor Trump have a plan for Black folks. I mean, mm-hmm. it just amazes me that people think that if Joe Biden gets into office, that things are going to be that vastly different. There's only two things to me. Well, there's really one, but I would say two things that Biden could do to show that he has the interest of, one would say, not only black people, but people of color, based on the way the society is moving forward. Number one, he would, for me, the most important thing would be that he stacks the court, the Supreme Court. Number two, if he's really about putting the Democratic Party in position to maybe have a stranglehold on not allowing the Republicans to get back into office, he should basically make Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. a state. Now, if they do those two things, then I would say that Biden did something for black people on a certain level that I think the society will only allow him to do. Remember this one thing. When they asked Kamala Harris what she was going to do for black folks, she said, I'm not going to do nothing for black folks. Because, to be honest with you, they can't do nothing for black folks without doing something for all the other people, because we haven't positioned ourselves, and in all truthfulness, we're too small of a minority, if the truth be told, to have them do anything for us. That's why I always laugh when people talk so bad about Trump, when if you look at the reality, anytime one perceives him to hurt black people, he's not only hurting black people, he's also hurting white people also. So if you look at the total dynamics, the mistake that we make as black people is we think that the so-called Democratic Party and their so-called leadership is going to do something that's in the best interest of black people, when the reality is the key things that need to be done that they could probably get away with that will be most beneficial to black people, they'll never do it. But black people don't think well enough to realize that if you stack the court, you'll be able to deal with all of the things that's really going to affect us when they get rid of the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And when they go and they do gerrymandering, which is coming.
Right.
And all of the other things that they're going to do to make it difficult for black folks to have some semblance, a.k.a., as everyone loves to talk about, which I think is BS, civil rights. But we don't think on those terms, because that's the key. Now, if they take away all of your rights, they take away all of the laws that y'all love so much and think it gave us some sort of position of progress in this country, if they take all of it away from you, then what position are you really in? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that's something that we don't think about, that we really don't understand, and that's why they'll just use us till the 4th. And when it's all said and done, he gets in office. The first thing he'll do is do what Obama did when he had control, if he gets control of the Senate in the House. He'll try to capitulate to Republicans and try to work with them. And in the process, like the Republicans did in 2008 to 2010, they'll play him to the next election, and then they'll get back control of one of the houses, and then they'll obstruct everything that he will try to do. Instead of him putting the hammer on them from day one, oh, he's going to play the Obama capitulation game. And when it's all said and done, Negroes will be in the same position four years later. That's right. All.
And that's why the activation piece is so important. is you to get out and fight to make sure that these changes can take place. Let me ask you, Shani and Sister Burrell, what's the timeline like for you? How are you going to determine to keep this keep the push going? What is it that you're doing in that relationship?
Well, we're asking for immediate action. Timeline as far as firing the police chief in Wauwatosa and Joseph Mensa, we want that to happen immediately. The things as far as like if they don't do it, the repercussions, I mean, well, the city of Wauwatosa is losing a lot of money. I want to say in a couple of days of protesting, Rebecca, you might want to correct me, but I know the Cheesecake Factory lost $20,000 and Mayfair lost $500,000. So those are significant numbers. You know, they're upset. You know, we're shaking something. And I know some people may say that's nothing compared to these multi-million dollar industries. Mm-hmm. But when you're hit with a pandemic like COVID, where you're not making a lot of money, that $20,000, that $500,000 means a lot.
Right.
You know, when you have to close down your businesses early because protesters are coming and you have people who are not willing to come and patronize your businesses. And we're also calling on a boycott, you know, for certain businesses. And that's to come. We definitely have more information to come. The People's Movement and also Revolution Ready and anybody who's supporting protests. If you are local in Milwaukee, Wisconsin or Wauwatosa, we do not patronize Mayfair Mall at all.
Mm-hmm.
But Becca, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, and just on a higher level, I mean, we are preparing for a civil war. America as we know it is not going to be the same. And I think that whoever sits in that justice seat is going to be changing a lot of things and a lot of laws regarding America. And I can't even say that I'm not hoping for a civil war because things have to turn upside down. The foundation of this country has to be uprooted. It's been rooted in slavery and on the backs of black people. And we shouldn't have to go anywhere. We are working on an exodus plan for black people. If they do want to go to another country, we will host workshops and teach them how to get out of America, or we will teach them the significance of buying up land. This whole cities and villages for sale. So buying up land and rebuilding a black Wall Street and being governed on our own, like that is something that is imagined. And if you can imagine it, you can attain it. And I don't believe that any of those parties have a black agenda, and they shouldn't, and they won't. And we know that from history. Like, when have they ever? So if we have our own agenda, we have to trust ourselves in order to have that agenda for black people. And I don't even believe that we are the minority. I believe that we are the majority, and that's a part of the problem they have now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And why do you say that, Ms. Burrell? I just want to confirm what you're saying. Why do you feel that we are the majority?
I feel that we are the majority because of how they mishandled the census. If we look at the census, and Shani can help me with this because she's like the human computer, but they mark down people. They don't give the option to certain people in order to say that they are African American, and some people just don't identify themselves as African American. A lot of black people don't even fill out census to say that we are the minority because they don't trust the government having their information.
Mm-hmm.
Like we, you know, and they have shown and proven that they use our information. They do it to us now, even protesting. They tap our phones. They, you know, ride past our house. They follow us around the city. I mean, I wouldn't trust them either. I know the census is important, but it's like a catch-22, just like the candidates for these presidential candidates and Senate candidates and mm-hmm. justice candidates.
Okay.
And I just want to add that the census considers North Africans white. They also consider, you know what I'm saying, 20% of the Hispanics who are African based or African people, Afro-Cubans or whatever, they consider them Hispanic. You know what I'm saying? So they're separating, they're dividing the numbers. And yes, we are definitely the majority. And I do want to say this, and because I forgot to mention it, we don't feel, or I don't feel, that Biden getting into office is going to change anything. Mm-hmm. I think that regardless on who's in office, we still got an agenda and we still applying pressure. If you don't speak to our needs, we going to be up in your face. Mm-hmm. And that's just what it is.
All right, just for our audience, one more time.
We actually did visit Trump.
Give us the information on how we can support you, some of the things that we can do to support you all. I just want to give it one more time in case there's somebody that wasn't on when you gave it before. What are some things that we can do, and what is the process for doing it?
You can email us at revolutionready.wi@gmail.com. And there, our secretary can give out information about what we need, or if you want to make a donation, if you're good at writing, if you're a scribe, or if you're good at organizing, then we can connect with you, and then we can connect the dots that way. We can network together.
Okay. All right. So now, Shani, I know you're going to talk about this on your program on Thursday. You want to talk a little bit about what you are planning to do and maybe let our audience know some of the things that you got coming
well,
up for after 7?
Absolutely. So Rebecca Burrell is going to join us as well. She's going to be talking about, you know, how she was able to put together the movement, the rally that she put together last week.
Right.
It was quick planning. She's going to go through some steps, the process, and then also give people an extra chance to connect, you know, so we can galvanize.
Great, great. You know, I know you were talking about the young white boy in Kenosha that had the gun that was walking up and down. I was also reading an article that there are millions of dollars that have been collected for his defense fund, and that's been used to wage his battle. It's interesting as you compare and contrast that to what you're trying to do for the African American, the Cole family, and some of the others, and. Any thoughts on that and where you think that's coming from and what does that say?
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely, because I know some of those numbers. $200,000 from a Christian organization was donated for his legal funds. Mm-hmm. I think it's disgusting. I don't want to throw any numbers out there as far as like what support we got from who or whomever got support from what organization. I just feel that, you know, if we can give $20 a month for a dog, or we can give or an organization to support dogs not, you know what I'm saying, being mistreated, we can give $20 a month or some type of donation towards these organizations that's out here on the front line. Black people, we need to support one another, and we're not doing that. And we can tell because there's a lack of resources in the Freedom Fund. There's a lack of resources for the Cole family for their support and their legal fees to get justice for their child. I think that we definitely have to do better. We do have to do better. Commit. You know, if you pay tithes, you know, you could pay something, you know, towards these organizations, because they definitely need your support.
Right. Now that's
and just to piggyback off of that though, Joseph Mensa, the officer who killed 3 people within 5 years, was granted money in order to move from one house to another house on the other side of the city. I believe it was like $69,000. They also took up a GoFundMe for him, and he's a killer, a serial killer. And the families, the 3 families, went to the court while we told the city hall in order to pull files in order to help them with their case. They stuck them with a $5,000 bill and didn't even give them the information yet. So when we went out to solicit for money for the families, we're soliciting money because they have court fees that they have to pay. We're soliciting money because our tires are popped. We went to Kenosha and they slashed 2 tires on each car in our caravan when we went up there. So cars have to be fixed. You know, we have our brakes need to be fixed. We when we go out, we caravan and we march. We caravan because people will drive through protesters or we caravan because they will point their beams at us. And if we see it for the protection of the people who are actually on the ground on foot walking. We also need medical supplies. Like even our med techs are being taken out and targeted one by one, just like that movie that you've seen. That's a reality for us. So we have medical supplies that we need. We have, you know, different things that we need in order to maintain protesting. Some of the protesters are out here and they've given their lives to justice, you know, they're fighting for justice, and you lose money in doing that. And some of them are still being affected by the COVID that came and they got laid off from their jobs, you know. So, I mean, what we're fighting for, it takes money.
Exactly. And, you know, it's so horrendous. When, like I said, when you look at some of the comparison figures, you've got billionaires, like right here in Wisconsin, there was an article in today's paper that three billionaires from Wisconsin, who are big industry owners, have donated $70 million to the GOP. And these are three individuals. The woman out of Beloit, Wisconsin, she owns the ABC Supply Company. She donated a very large sum of money. In Janesville, there's a woman by the name of Diane Hendricks. She has donated a huge sum of money. The Eline family here, who own the Eline Hall and all of that stuff downtown, they've donated millions of dollars to the Trump campaign and the Republican Party. So we can support these our efforts, and it's horrible to think that we're not doing that, and particularly the churches who very clearly are supposedly standing in the front, supposed to be caring about the work of, you know, the Christian soldiers, and what are they doing? And you cannot get any support from them whatsoever. NAACP, you know, and the things that it should be doing, it's not doing. It's just horrible. And so we definitely want to encourage any of our listeners who are listening to, please, by all means, reach out and support these two organizations. These organizations are collective organizations, but you can just email the sister. And one more time, give me that number one more time, sister. I mean, your email address, so just in case. I just want to make sure that everybody is clear and hearing it.
Okay. I'll give you the email, but it's not just the churches either. You have mosques, you have Buddhist temples, you have other people that stand up for righteousness. So I don't want to just put it all
on
the Christian church. Revolution Ready, revolutionready.wi@gmail.com.
Okay. All right. We've got about 8 minutes left. Sister, you want to give us some closing remarks in terms of your work and what you're doing? We really appreciate you coming on and opening up about this fight, the activism that you're doing, and hopefully encouraging others that will join you and help and support, if not on the front lines, by just doing it financially. Would you have some closing remarks? Sister Burrell?
I would say that in order for us to change the narrative, we have to change. It first starts with us. We know what the government and what America as a whole, what they have done, Willie Lynch, their plans are working perfectly. They're doing what they set out to do. And I would say that we need to stick together. A lot of what we've been going through has been a head-butted situation because of different beliefs or different backgrounds, but at the same time, we have to put all of those personal issues to the side and think what is good, what is for the greater good. And we have to put our egos to the side. And instead of saying, well, I'm not going to help because of X, Y, Z, how about we look on a positive side and say, well, I'm going to help because of this, and this is what I have to put forth, and I'm going to do my best at doing this thing that I can do well, and be hopeful with the people around you that we are going to make the change that is needed. This country cannot be the same. It will not be the same. If it turned into Iraq, it has turned into Iraq. But I can promise you, we not going back down from fighting this fight.
All right. Now, this is the future, folks. This is what we talk about all the time. you know, what is the future going to look like? Well, you're hearing them tonight, and they're telling you what they're doing. Shani?
All right. So, yeah, like my sister said, we're not backing down. I want everybody to remember, you know, that we're living in history right now. 30, 20 years down the road, you know, we don't want to be the generation or whatever that didn't do anything. We don't want to be the generation or whatever that sat down and allowed something to happen. We're at the finish line. We just have a little bit more more work to do, but we're definitely getting it done. Okay. And I don't know how long it's going to take, but we're going to get it done.
All right. Brother Lush, you have any closing remarks for these young ladies? Brother Lush, you have any closing remarks for these young ladies?
I'm sorry, I was on mute.
That's all right.
All the best to you and your endeavors, and I look forward to supporting you with a few dollars, hopefully that could contribute towards your efforts.
Great. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Okay. Brother Jay, I'm so happy you joined to call us. I really appreciate you. Always enjoy hearing you. You got any last remarks for these two young ladies?
Hey, Doc, man, it's so good, as I said, to hear your voice. As far as the two ladies, I support you. I will definitely try and make a donation. Just be safe out there. Watch your back.
Right.
And watch some of these so-called Negroes that are your friends. Because they're really nothing more than gatekeepers. But, hey, Dr. Hughes, can you do one thing?
Yes.
I think you need to do a show on what is black people gonna do if Trump get back in the office. That's a very important show.
Say that once more, say it one more time. Repeat that again once more.
What is black people gonna do if Trump get back into office?
Got you. Oh, yeah.
That's a very important show.
I'm glad you said that.
Because a lot of our people, I think, are gonna be so demoralized and so beaten down that it's no telling how many of them are going to become suicidal.
Okay, got you. I got you. That's a good one. Yeah, that's a whole trauma thing. Yes, sir. Brother Timothy, any closing remarks for these young ladies?
Yes, I want to hook up with those young ladies. The donation is important. We need to talk, stay focused, and be optimistic. And I like what you're saying about the voting. But like you said, you want legislation put in that you want to vote for. And listen, this is not a waste. And listen, don't think history doesn't repeat itself. But take my advice, ladies. We're going to win. Have it in your mind that when we fight, we win.
All right. I love it. Thank all of you for your comments and your suggestions. Thank all of our listening audience, whether you called in or were just listening via the internet or telephone. We appreciate you. We thank you so much. We'll see you back here next week, next Tuesday. At 7 p.m. Have a wonderful and blessed week. Thank you, ladies. I will be listening right there with you on Thursday as you talk further about this subject. Thursday on after 7 with host Shani B. Here, right here on timeforanawakening.com. Take care, folks. Have a good week.
Understand what black is, the source from which all things come, security blanket for the stars. Understand what black is. It's not a color, it's the basis of all colors. It is not a complexion, it is a reflection of all complexions called human. And out of this blackness, passion flows like a river. Feelings tell the truth. Song and dance and making you laugh are family members. Understand what black is. The breath you breathe, the sweat on your brow, the cheers and the tears balancing the world on your head. Faith is the glue that holds us all together. This is your blackness. Some horror story of lost souls drifting into the land of perversion stand black. Offers comfort in turbulent times, provides food.